Welcome to our discussion segment on The Civil War Part 1. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. Hey, John.
Hey.
So part one of a very large topic, the Civil War.
Yep. Biggest one we've addressed since the World Wars.
Yeah.
Back in season one.
Yeah. Before we jump into this, John, I had a question about when you teach this in your classes. When you teach this, what are some common misconceptions when it comes to this time period?
The biggest one is that the Civil War was solely about slavery. It was largely about that, but the bigger sectional issue between the North and the South was the question of states' rights versus national power. States' rights, yes, to own slaves, but also to control their own tariffs, to control their own local economies, and things like that. So while the war resulted in the end of slavery, it did not start, as I said, I think in part one, over the issue of slavery.
Okay.
Over the issue of slavery alone, again.
So what are some things that surprise you about what students know or don't know?
Again, there are a lot, but the biggest one is they think the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves.
Okay.
It didn't. I always ask them, how many slaves were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation? The number is usually, well, like all of them? No, it only freed slaves that were liberated by the Union Army after January 1st, 1863. It's not until this, we get the 13th Amendment that slavery is abolished everywhere in the United States.
Why is that? Why do students have that thought?
I think probably because it has the word emancipation in it. I don't think that it's like intentional misconstruing of history on the part of other history teachers or the History Channel or anything like that. I think it's just, well, they hear the word emancipate, which means
right.
to free, to liberate. And they think, oh, well, yeah, the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves. Freed some of them.
Right.
But not all.
You said that while the war did not begin solely on the issue of slavery, it's in corresponded with the ending of the greatest shame in all of American history.
Just an opinion statement, I'll grant you.
No,
but
well,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. And I agree. My question is, how is it possible for a land that purported freedom for all to allow and encourage the exact opposite in what we see in slavery?
That's usually the first question that students will ask. It's like, wait, America is the land of the free and the home of the brave. The short answer to your question is because a majority of Americans did not believe that African slaves were fully human and thus deserved the same natural rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence by God, those didn't apply to them.
But the idea that they weren't fully human had to begin somewhere.
Where did that come from? I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. It comes from a history of people judging those who have different color skin as being different, combined with the tragic practice of several religions, predominantly in the West, Christianity, using scripture to support slavery. The Bible mentions slavery, and yes, the Old Testament endorses it, but the New Testament does not.
Right.
Still, you get a great deal of controversy with some pastors saying slavery is fine and other pastors saying, no, slavery is an abomination. But it's a gradual evolution of a, quote, pseudo-scientific, because there were race theorists out there. It's a pseudo-scientific theory. But I think the deeper reason why so many people said, oh, yeah, they're not human, I don't think they had a reason for it. I think it was just convenient. They rationalized their abuse of other human beings because they had a different color skin, because in their minds, they needed these people to do the work because it was easier to enslave them than to pay workers or to go do the work themselves on the plantations. So I don't have a time machine, and the accounts that I've read from like Southern ministers and Southern politicians, they always have a justification of slavery. But I think I'd be willing to bet that a lot of average Southerners, maybe they owned a couple slaves, maybe they didn't, but they were fine with it. And they didn't really, just because I am. It's not, I don't need to have a justification for it.
What was America in 1860 and how did it get that way?
It was a very divided country. It was a country where after Dred Scott, the political process to address the issues of slavery and states' rights versus national power had completely broken down, because Dred Scott was a ruling by, I think, 4 of the 7 or maybe 5 of the 7 justices who were then on the Supreme Court, making slavery legal everywhere in the United States. It voided all laws that had instituted any kind of federal controls on slavery, like the Northwest Ordinance that said you can't have slavery in the Midwest, what is today the Midwest. Voided all of those and said, if a state wants to have slavery, regardless of where it's located, they can have slavery. And the American people said, okay, well, we've been arguing over slavery for 30 years, since 1820. Now you've taken that away from us, so what's the only recourse? The Constitution has failed us, according to William Seward, who was the leading Republican before Abraham Lincoln's rise. So what do? When the Constitution doesn't work, when the political process fails, we look to the higher law in this country, the higher law of the Declaration of Independence. And it says that if a government becomes destructive of these ends of protection of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, natural rights, and all of that, it is the right and duty of the people to alter or abolish that government and to create a new one. And so in the South, we get secession. And in the North, we get what Abraham Lincoln called the new birth of freedom, in which the United States casts off not just the institution of slavery, but a lot of the traditions that existed before the Civil War, and we create pretty much a new country.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be an alliance of sovereign states. Now we are going to be one nation, more of a federal system. I'm sorry, more of a centralized system than the old Federalist interpretation of the Constitution that predated the Civil War.
Okay.
So very divided and getting worse in 1860, and that ultimately leads to the bloodshed at Fort Sumter.
Was the Civil War always inevitable?
No.
Or was there an opportunity early on in our history to end slavery? And if so, would the cost have been more or less, considering we would be setting the example of people having individual rights, every person being equal?
Well, there's two questions there.
Right.
So, no, the Civil War was not inevitable until Dred Scott. Dred Scott made the Civil War inevitable because, again, the political process fails. So what do we have left? We have the resort to arms. It wasn't inevitable in 1860. It could have taken, you know, another couple of years, maybe another decade or two, but it was going to happen once the Supreme Court intervened and said, you, the American people, don't have a voice in this. We are going to impose our will on you. Could slavery have been prevented, or could the Civil War have been prevented? The most obvious answer is yes, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia way back in 1787. As we're writing the Constitution, a lot of Northerners say we want to ban slavery, and the South say, well, we're not going to sign the Constitution. And so the Founding Fathers put aside the issue of slavery because they believed slavery was on its way out as an economic system, and it was. More on that in a second. And they said, in the interest of national unity, we're going to permit slavery to exist. We're going to protect it by having sectional balance in the South. We're going to include the Three-Fifths Compromise to give Southern states a larger measure of representation. And we're going to allow the international slave trade for the first 20 years under the Constitution. Going forward, it was going to be more difficult because now it's one country. And again, the political process is such that Northern and Southern states are roughly equal. And since the House and the Senate both have to agree to a bill or to a constitutional amendment, because of equal representation in the Senate, you're not going to get any kind of abolition bill through Congress. Now, the big problem with the Founding Fathers' idea that slavery was on its way out is they didn't consider any kind of innovation. And 7 years after the Constitution was written, Eli Whitney develops the cotton gin. Before the cotton gin, slavery was a very inefficient model of economic organization. You get far better work out of people if you pay them than if you threaten to beat them.
Right.
But with the cotton gin, which is a giant machine where instead of having to pick through a bale of cotton, you just run it through the machine and it takes all the seeds out, one slave can now do the work of what used to take 10. And so the other nine, what do? They don't get freed. Certainly not. They get sent into the fields. And slavery becomes more efficient. It's still not as efficient as a free market where people are paid, but it becomes more efficient. And that guarantees slavery's continuation in the South, ironically, against the wishes of Eli Whitney. He wanted to try to make slaves' lives easier to hasten the end of the South's, quote, peculiar institution.
So the time preceding the Civil War was not the first time in our history when states threatened to not be part of it anymore, right?
Right.
So thinking the two examples I found were the War of 1812 and the 1832 tariffs.
Nullification crisis.
So was the difference specifically the Scott case? Was that the catalyst, the main one? Or what was different about this time period?
No, it was the 1860 election.
Okay.
And it was the fact that, again, slavery had become so divisive. It had unified the South and the North on opposite sides, and they were able to get enough people to support secession. Secession was never a majority in New England during the War of 1812. The Federalists were able to convince some people to talk about secession, but it was not a majority, and we won the war before they could actually get their measures through the various state legislatures. In 1832, Andrew Jackson responded very, very aggressively, passed the Force Bill, deployed troops to South Carolina, blockaded Charleston Harbor. He was not going to let South Carolina leave the Union because he foresaw that other states might try and he wasn't having any of that. Because it was an election, because the Southern states did not even have the opportunity to vote against Lincoln because his name didn't appear on the ballot, and because of the inherent difficulties of a presidential transition, which used to be almost 6 months. Hmm. Now it's like three. Now it's a little more than 2 months, actually. It used to be election day, first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and then you were inaugurated on March 4th of the following year. That long time span and the fact that Lincoln's election was so controversial basically gave the South the time they needed to get organized, declare independence basically within the same two-month period. Seven states broke away, and they had a man in the White House, James Buchanan, who said, "This is not my problem. Lincoln's election caused this, so I'm not going to take any action one way or the other. I'm not going to encourage secession, but I'm also not going to call up troops and suppress secession the way that Andrew Jackson did."
Okay.
And that's why they were able to get away. It's also why Buchanan is regularly cited as one of the worst presidents in our history.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Also the only bachelor president and allergic to peanuts. I have no idea why I know this.
It's just random information.
Random information
you found
that
out.
I have.
Yeah. So when I talk to people about the Civil War, the states' rights issue, obviously that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
It's an interesting argument to me because the Declaration of Independence, though not a legal document, how's the ideals we would employ within the Constitution.
Right.
In fact, the Bill of Rights is not written to one race, but to everyone, right? I mean, it's written to everyone.
Yeah.
Okay. So if
to
that's
all Americans.
Right, all yes. Americans. If this is true, was it truly a states' rights issue if we're violating what our law says?
Again, you're making the mistake of Carlyle that we talked about a couple weeks ago in the Romanticism episode. You are putting your correct moral interpretation of the nature of humanity onto the Southerners. The Southerners did not believe that African Americans were human. So why would we don't give legal rights to cows. We don't give legal rights to our pets.
Man,
why would we give legal rights to these people who are working in our fields? Again, I want to say it very clearly. I'm not defending this proposition. It repulses me. Students, their eyes get a little wide the first time I have to say something, basically what the South would say. And I'm like, what did you just say? And I always have to make it very clear because I don't know who's recording me and is going to like try and get me canceled someday. I am not defending, I am not supporting what the South believed or what they did, but that was their mindset.
Okay. The challenge that I have is like even going back to our founders, I know the moral standpoint that they were working from seems to be clear in their written text that all men are created equal.
Yeah.
But then privately, they didn't believe that.
Yes, they did.
But why didn't they end slavery then?
Because they didn't believe that slaves were men, were people.
So there
Washington,
was
Jefferson, Madison.
So there was literally a distinction that they made in their minds.
Yes.
When they thought of
absolutely
humans, they thought if the human has a different color, then they're not as human.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
So when they wrote those things, they weren't thinking it was specifically true. Or in their minds, they thought it was true because they didn't see everyone as equal.
They did not see a contradiction between the practice of chattel slavery and a declaration that all men are created equal. Same was true with women. Women were not protected under the original interpretation of the Declaration of Independence. They didn't have equal rights. They didn't have the right to vote. They couldn't own property in their own name. They couldn't get custody of their children in the event of a divorce. We don't get that until after the Civil War.
Okay.
And the feminist movement actually put aside their quest for equality, because that started in 1844, I believe it was, at Seneca Falls. They decided, okay, we are going to put aside our activism for legal equality, specifically to join the abolitionist movement, because there are some among us who are not even considered to be people, who are property. So we are going to, let's solve that problem first, and then we'll talk about equality for women.
Okay. How far does the states' rights argument go? Because again, when this is presented to me, I think through all of that, but also once the state has seceded from the Union, they no longer fall under the category of having states' rights. They're a separate country, right? They're no longer part of the same Union that would grant the rights.
It's interesting you bring that up because Lincoln was simultaneously saying that they are a foreign country and thus do not have any protections under the Constitution. And they're also not a foreign country, but a rebelling state, and therefore do have some protections. And he had to thread that needle very, very carefully because for him to be using war powers, there had to be a declared war. And you can't declare war on your own states. So when Congress called up the volunteers, which was the formal declaration of war, he said, his message to Congress was, this is a foreign power that we are going to have to fight. And therefore, he could engage in all these war powers. But at the same time, for him to say it's a foreign power, he had to acknowledge secession was legal, which gave the Peace Democrats an opportunity to say, hey, just let the South go. They'll eventually come back. George McClellan, his opponent in 1864, made that argument. Slavery is again on its way out, which it wasn't, but McClellan, he was delusional in many ways, on and off the battlefield.
Right.
His idea was you let the states go when you called up troops to repel a foreign invader. Lincoln said, no, I didn't. I called up troops to suppress a domestic insurrection. And the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, if it's a domestic insurrection, you can't suspend the writ of habeas corpus, you can't impose martial law, you can't do all the things you did in Maryland and in New York and elsewhere. Lincoln is at the same time saying the South is and is not a foreign country. And the war ended, and the Supreme Court kind of said, well, the war's over, so we're not going to rule on this.
Yeah, so the follow-up to that is, what did the law say?
The Constitution is not clear, and still is not clear. There has not been a ruling on the issue of secession, except in the case of Texas, because Texas entered the Union as a foreign country, and the annexation treaty says that Texas can leave, and every couple of years or so, Texans get angry and say, we're going to secede, and I don't think that's going to happen. The Civil War settled the issue of secession, at least in the minds of most people. Now, could you make a case for a state other than Texas seceding today? You could, but it all rests on the last page of the Constitution of the United States. Are the states, are those signatures, is that the American people as a whole? Do those signatures represent the American people as a whole, in which case we are one nation indivisible? Or are they signing for their states? If they're signing for their states, then since the states created the Constitution, they can then leave. But if it's the people as a whole, then it requires the assent of the people, meaning their representatives in Congress, to allow a state to leave. Hmm.
So, John, I just have to go back to an earlier question I asked you.
It's sticking in your mind, isn't it?
It is, because yeah. I'm going to be honest, I'm internally very angry.
Yeah.
Because when I'm thinking about the founders, I've always known that they're flawed men.
Yeah.
They're not. But when I'm thinking about the documents that allowed us to be seen as free people, when you read the text, there's no distinction in race. But what we've just talked about, there was in their mind. So, instantly, my mind goes to the concept of the Constitution being a living, breathing document, something that changes with the times. Because right now, as you've clearly stated, and as I have, obviously this time in slavery had to die.
Yes.
It had to be destroyed and decimated and wiped off. It should never have been in existence anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in a society that purported individual freedom. So with that in mind, like, is there an argument to say that such documents that defined our law should be considered, okay, we need to change them and reinterpret them using...
Whoa. Okay, so now well,
that's specifically,
totally
it's a specific word.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say that we need to see them in the light of current day and say, okay, what's real, what's law, and what's not?
So, and here some of my conservative friends may disagree with me, but should we see the Constitution as a living, breathing document? Yes. Because unlike the English Bill of Rights or Magna Carta or things like that, the Founding Fathers brilliantly, I think, recognized that public morals and beliefs are going to change, and they didn't want to freeze the United States into a late 18th century mindset. So they built into the document a correcting instrument, and that is the process found in Article 5 of amending the Constitution. The Constitution can be changed, and it is thus a living document. It's breathing. I don't know. I don't like that term
because that's right.
But people say it. So, can slavery be amended? Or I'm sorry, can the Constitution be amended to end slavery? Yes, absolutely. And the 13th Amendment did that.
Right.
Can it be amended to include a clear definition of people, regardless of race, color, class, or creed, as citizens of the United States? Yes. That's what the 14th and 15th Amendments did. Interpretation is where we have an issue. And there's a great deal of argument in constitutional law about how far originalism versus activism should be involved. Originalism says you go with the intent of the Founding Fathers. Well, that works in some cases, because the intent of the Founding Fathers was to create a democratic constitutional republic with checks and balances and protection of minority rights and things like that. But the Founding Fathers' intent was also to permit an economic system that allowed people to own other people. So originalism will only take you so far. Activism, the other extreme, is where you look at an individual judges or a group of justices on the Supreme Court or a certain political party, their interpretation of what the Constitution should say is what motivates Supreme Court and lower court rulings. I tend to think that both of these are a bad idea. I think what you do is you go with what is known as constructionism. It's kind of a middle ground. What does the document actually say? Strip aside intent, strip aside personal feelings. Because when you read, as you said, the documents themselves, when you read the Declaration, when you read the Constitution, there is no distinction between race, color, class, or creed. That's what you need to follow. And as you amend the Constitution, you should be trying to bring the document and bring interpretations from both the left, the right, the center, wherever, in line with what the document actually says. The Declaration of Independence condemns slavery. Constitution mentions it and acknowledges that it exists in this country and was then amended to remove those provisions. You don't have the Three-Fifths Compromise anymore or anything like that. So as the country moves forward and deals with the continuing issues of race that still exist in this country, deals with other political questions, social questions, moral questions, the framework of amending the Constitution should be, what does the document actually say? Now, we don't amend the Constitution anymore. We have judges just amend it for us, which is
a whole other topic.
A whole other topic, and I think very dangerous on both sides of the political aisle. I don't want far right-wing judges imposing their view on America any more than I want far left-wing
Correct.
Judges.
Yeah, I
but
agree.
The point of the living document, the spine, as you would say, of a living and breathing Constitution of the United States should be the text. We should be textualists. We should be strict constructionalists. Shouldn't be originalists trying to read the Federalist Papers and figure out what they're trying to do, what their intent was. We shouldn't be activists, you know, looking at what Twitter says to decide what a judge should do. We should use the text of the documents.
All right. Well, a lot of heavy topics there for sure. Why did the majority of commissioned officers in the U.S. Army resign their posts and join the Confederate Army?
Because they were from the South, and it was their states that were seceding. The South has always had a more militaristic, more martial spirit than the North has. The North was more about commerce and trade and things like that.
Yeah. So none of them had the conviction?
A few did.
Okay.
A few, yeah. Not every Southern officer resigned, but the vast majority of them did.
Okay. So all of the battle experience went southward?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why did the two sides believe the war would be short in the first year? Were they just underestimating the type of war that it was going to be?
They didn't understand how technology had changed. Just like almost every war. Going forward to World War I, going back to the 30 Years' War, they didn't understand that technology had created the means for mass slaughter over a long period of time at greater range. And they also underestimated the passion that the South and the North would have for their causes and a desire to hold out for as long as possible. I mean, even after General Sherman, to jump ahead to next week's episode, burned literally the heart out of the Confederacy's war effort with his march to the sea across Georgia.
Yeah.
They're like, oh no, we're going to keep fighting. With what? On paper, there is no way you can win. Really, after Vicksburg, there is no way the South can win. And yet, we're going to keep going. We have one of my students, you know, every time we talk about this in military history class, he always shouts, they had spirit! And that's really what they had.
As the war went on, though, they changed their mindset, right? They believed that it would probably take longer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. After the first major battle at Bull Run, and certainly after Shiloh, in April of 1862, they realized, okay, yeah, this is going to take longer than we thought.
So nowadays in combat, sides can communicate fairly well. And when you were talking about how in one area the South did great, and then in other areas it did not. Mm-hmm. Was there a link between those two groups? Was there a communication?
Not much. No, the two theaters operated pretty much independently.
So with the South not doing well in one theater, was their mindset at the time, we're not going to last long, versus the one that was doing well? And was there a conflict there?
Well, I mean, the War Department in Richmond they were getting reports from both sides, but they weren't necessarily telling General Lee or the various generals in the Western theater the full picture of what's going on. I haven't read documentation, so this is a guess, but my guess is the War Department thought, well, General Lee will take Washington and force the North to agree to a peace treaty long before Grant and Sherman and the other Western generals are able to overrun our base of supply. Both sides knew the war was ultimately going to be decided in the East, in that 100-plus miles between Washington and Richmond.
Hmm. Can you give a brief overview of the battle tactics of the armies during this time period? And as a follow-up, how did this war change conflicts afterward in terms of strategy and tactics?
Yeah. it was very similar to Revolutionary War style in the beginning, in terms of you fought in line and columns. You stood with your fellow soldiers in a line of usually three deep. First rank fired, then dropped to their knees to start to reload. Second rank fired, then dropped to their knees. Third rank fire. There was a bit more movement. Cavalry is more involved because of the larger population. You can have larger armies, thus, you know, larger number of men in cavalry. So there is a little bit more mobility, but the focus was still in breaking the enemy lines, or even better, flanking them, getting around from either on either their left or their right. The problem was initially, and why you see so many casualties, is the armies are very, very close. They're typically about 40 to 50 yards apart, because that's what Revolutionary War, War of 1812, and Mexican War doctrine called for. Because at the time, they're using smoothbore muskets that are gradually improving, but still have maybe an effective range of at most 30, 40, maybe 50 yards. But by the Civil War, they're using rifles, weapons that have rifling in the barrel that allow the bullet to spin, an increasing range out to like 300, 400 yards. Well, if I'm standing 50 yards away from you with a musket and I fire at you, there's maybe a 1 in 3 chance I hit you. But if I got an 1861 Springfield rifle and you're 50 yards away and I fire at you, you are going to die. And so you have huge numbers of casualties in those early battles. So the evolution, the first evolution in war, was get the armies further apart. And so now you're firing at a mass of blue. You don't actually see the person at 50 yards right before you kill him. The other major innovation that happens in what we're going to talk about next week is the origins of trench warfare. Soldiers digging rifle pits and eventually complex trenches, specifically around the city of Petersburg in southern Virginia in the war's final year, to shelter themselves from this hail of bullets, especially on the southern side. They're doing this because they're just outnumbered in every battle after Gettysburg in 1864 and 1865.
It's always interesting to read back on those battle tactics of line, like line and column, mm-hmm. lining up and facing someone or a group and just standing there and firing while they stand there and fire at you. Was there a beginning, a shift of we need cover and firing from cover?
I mean, they fired from cover whenever they could.
Okay.
But it was still majority line and column.
Yeah. It's just
certainly in open fields.
Yeah. So Antietam was just a terrible battle.
One of many.
Yeah. And in terms of it being awful, even though the North won, mm-hmm. in quotes, it did win,
it did.
But
it was
a huge, yeah. huge, just in loss. It was massive.
Yeah, it was the bloodiest single day in American history.
Yeah.
Despite what my niece's teacher once told her, took a point off on a test. She said, no, Gettysburg was worse. Gettysburg was over 4 days, you idiot. This is a teacher telling Rowena this. Anyway, sorry.
That's okay. So after that battle was won, what effect did that win have on the North and the South?
It didn't have much of an effect on the South. The South fell back and said, all right, we'll try it again. The biggest effect on the North was Burnside took command, replacing McClellan, because Burnside actually managed to have the only success in which he took a bridge.
Yeah.
Which that was...
Worth it or not worth it? Probably not worth
well,
it.
Especially because the bridge was not that big and the soldiers could very easily have just like gone down and crossed over the creek. But no, his orders were take the bridge. So he's going to take the bridge. He has a laser-like focus. He's going to follow orders, which means that when he's running an entire army, his laser-like focus is...
He's not creative. He doesn't have ingenuity.
That's what leads to Fredericksburg. The other major outcome of Antietam was the Emancipation Proclamation. It was the closest thing to a victory that Lincoln had, and so he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, I think, 4 days after the Battle of Antietam.
Mm-hmm. Why did the actions of Sherman and others in the army who gave men, women, and children who were freed from bondage, they gave them property, they gave them other assistance, mm-hmm. as they transitioned from slavery
yeah.
to being what they were always supposed to be, free? Why did that cause controversy? And again, I'm not trying to see it from my perspective currently.
No, I'm trying to understand. It's a great question.
And Sherman we'll talk about him more yeah. soon. But in terms of like causing controversy, these are people who are also seeing mm-hmm. the horrors of this evil blight. It's called slavery, and they're like, "Well, I'm not so sure you could do this." Like, what are you talking about? And so
well,
yeah.
Okay, let's think about this. Taking property from someone unwillingly, what is that?
It's
legally,
theft.
That is theft. Okay. Unless what happens? It is only not theft if it's taxation. No. If it is what?
I don't know.
The result of you committing a crime. The government has the right to take property from you if you have committed a crime. So what crime had the slave owners in Georgia and in other southern states where this occurred, what crime had they committed?
So I'm a little confused because I don't consider them states anymore. They've seceded. They're not states, right?
Well, no, the appropriation and all of that, that happened after the state had been reabsorbed. It happened after they were conquered.
Okay, so we're talking about like post-war.
No, no. We're talking about as soon as Sherman goes through an area, that area is now under U.S. administration. It is now a reconstructed part of these states.
Yeah.
So what crime have those citizens committed?
I don't know.
They haven't committed a crime. Because slavery was not a crime when they enslaved these people. You cannot retroactively punish someone for something that was not a crime when they did it. That's where the controversy came in. And that is the biggest problem with Reconstruction and the question of reparations, both then and now. How can you, again, you have to separate out your justified moral outrage towards slavery with the legal question. Because if the government can say, this is a crime, such and such an action is a crime, and then punish you for doing it before they declared it was a crime, that's setting a precedent that no one in this country wants. At some point, they just declare something else to be a crime. You're wearing a gray vest. If the government says that is now a crime, oh gosh, I didn't know. Well, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You should have known. Right, but it wasn't a crime at the time. Sorry, we're now going to fine you $1,000 for doing that.
Sherman treated it as a crime.
He did. And that was technically unconstitutional, which is why his order was ultimately reversed by Congress and the Supreme Court. And all that property was taken from the slaves and given back to the slave owners. Because, again, I hate to say it, they had not committed a legally defined crime, and thus their property, homes, food, money, etc., that was taken from them by Union soldiers should not have been taken from them, and it was given back.
Should it just have been confiscated?
Well,
because they're an invading army on technically foreign soil.
It's not foreign soil.
But, I mean, they seceded from the Union.
But secession is illegal. It was a rebellion.
According to Abraham
Lincoln.
According
to President Lincoln, and according to the Supreme Court, and according to most people at the time. Very few Northerners accepted secession, other than the Peace Democrats.
So were they just playing pretend?
Yeah, they were treating the South, yes. They were trying to have it both ways. Just like in 1787, the Founding Fathers tried to have it both ways. Politics is very often about holding contradictory ideas in your head about cognitive dissonance.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I think if you were in the same position, if you were President Lincoln, you would probably have done the same thing. Because he needed to run the Civil War as both a war against a foreign power and the suppression of a civil uprising.
Hmm.
He had to have it both ways. And so he did. And, you know, deal with the consequences later on.
Okay. In a letter to Horace Greeley in 1862, Lincoln makes it clear that his first obligation is to preserve the Union.
Mm-hmm.
But he believes that all men should be free. In other letters, he stated that there was no way he could not end slavery. And even 10 years earlier, he spoke about the dangerous presence of slavery. Despite him winning the war, he still ended it. He preserved the Union, but he still said, this is morally wrong. We have to stop this now. So in the podcast, you said that he was not an abolitionist. But
correct.
Was that only in name itself? Because it seems like he had a history of saying this blight should end. It should not be in existence anymore.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, leading up to the war, during the war. As I said, he could have preserved the Union and not ended it, but he did end it because it was wrong. So,
or did he end it to stop this happening again?
I'm just going by what he wrote, his personal convictions.
When did he write that letter to Horace Greeley? It was 1862, so during the war. Okay.
Yeah.
For most of Lincoln's political life, he was not an abolitionist. It was called a free soiler. He believed in letting slavery exist where it already was, where it was established, but not extending it as America grew. Those areas should all remain free. His statements, because he also made other statements, you've cited some statements by Lincoln 10 years before the outbreak of the war. There are also statements of him saying, I do not believe that a white man and a black man are equal. They are equal in the eyes of God, but they should not be equal in law. Lincoln was a politician, and politicians say contradictory things all the time. It's not to justify, again,
right,
with that caveat. So I think it's important to judge Lincoln's actions, not his motivations. And his actions were absolutely the right ones when it came to ending slavery. When I teach through this whole thing, with students, and I'm not saying this is the only way to address this topic, so don't take it that way. And I'm glad you asked the question, but I don't focus, unless the students ask, on Lincoln's motivations, mm-hmm. specifically regarding slavery, because it's confusing. And people have done this. They have written whole books saying Lincoln is like the greatest president of all time, greater than George Washington, because he said this about slavery. And others, like in the same year, I remember Henry Jaffa and I forget the name of the anti-Lincoln guy, it might have been Shelby Foote, wrote books like that came out within weeks of each other, all based on a single quote by Lincoln. And Harry Jaffa is saying Lincoln's the greatest, and Shelby Foote is saying, no, he's a dictator, and he's a tyrant, and he destroyed the Constitution. And they're basing it off of quotes. My personal opinion, I don't have nearly the stature of these men, and I'm not criticizing those men or anyone who's written a book about Lincoln, but my perspective is you judge him based on his actions, and his actions during the war in the quest to end slavery were absolutely the right ones to do.
Yeah, I agree. So two last questions for you.
Okay.
Should a nation be judged by its bad actions?
No.
I'm not done. Or the actions it took to make right its wrongs?
Neither. No. Okay. I should clarify. What do you mean judged? Like have an opinion? You can have whatever opinion you want about the United States.
When someone looks back at our history and they try to look at the whole of our history and say, is this a good or bad country?
Yeah.
Obviously, that's somewhat subjective, right?
Right. I think you look at the totality of what that country did.
And that's kind of the question.
That's entirely subjective. So okay. I have less of an opinion. When students come in and they say, you know, I think America is this racist, sexist country. Like, okay, why? And we have a conversation. I'm not mean. I don't try and convince them otherwise because that's an opinion. And my job is not to change students' opinions. My job is to present the facts and teach them how to form, you know, their own opinions. So when students leave my class, you know, super right wing or super left wing or super man, I don't care about politics. That's fine. They've got the facts. And when it becomes necessary for them to form an opinion, they will. Now, the question becomes, when should a current government, local, state, federal, try to right a historic wrong because of something that was done in the past? That's where you get very, very serious. And that's where I think that you do have to have a pretty strong opinion on these things. You need to judge situations. You need to judge cases. You need to deal with historic injustices very, very, very carefully. Because a lot of people will commit the sin of Carlyle that we talked about a couple weeks ago, will turn history into a weapon in order to enact modern agendas that can be very, very detrimental and can lead to the same kinds of demonization, the same kinds of discrimination, the same kinds of unpersoning that happened in the United States and in the 13 colonies before it that led ultimately to the great tragedy that was the Civil War.
Thank you for joining us in this discussion of the Civil War Part 1. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thank you, and see you all next week.